I wonder if you're familiar with Murphy's Law. The original Murphy was an engineer who conducted an experiment to test human acceleration tolerances. You thought I was going to say he was an Irishman, didn't you? Unfortunately for him, he installed 16 motion sensors the wrong way, leading to the now famous quotation, "If anything can go wrong, it will." I guess the corollary is also true. If anything can't go wrong, it will anyway. Here are some other laws that are blamed on the poor Mr. Murphy. You might have heard some of them. Left to themselves, things tend to go from bad to worse. Heard that one? No, okay. Matter will be damaged in direct proportion to its value. Too complicated, isn't it? You will never find a lost article until you replace it. That's very true for me at this particular moment. Here's another one. Everything goes wrong all at once. Yep. Finally, if everything seems to be going well, you are obviously overlooking something. That's true. That's true, even if you've not put it in those precise words. So, as we come to Nehemiah, everything seems to be going wrong all at once. This story is a mixture of emotions. In chapter 1, we looked at how Nehemiah prayed, how he responded to the devastation of the walls being down. In chapter 2, we saw how God moved him from the prosperity of Persia to the desolation of Jerusalem. And then last week, we thought very wonderfully about unity. And we were introduced to the wall workers and discovered that in kingdom work, no one can do everything, but everyone can do something. And because some worked harder, and Barak worked with more zeal than anyone else, the construction project was really zipping along really quick. But when we come to chapter 4, suddenly there's a problem. Things start to get more complicated for Nehemiah. And Mr. Murphy and his laws turns up and reminds Nehemiah that when everything seems to be going well, then you've obviously overlooked something. There's a plague around, or an epidemic in our lives sometimes, and it's what we would call discouragement. And I see it so often in church. I see it in my life. I see it in other people's lives. And discouragement has at least three things that makes it a very potent problem. Some of you live with discouragement. Well, discouragement is universal. None of us are immune to discouragement. Everyone you've ever known has been discouraged at one time or another. And discouragement is recurring. Being discouraged once does not give you an immunity to the disease. Yes, it gives you an edge, a bit of an experience, but it doesn't stop discouragement coming back. You can be discouraged over and over again. In fact, you can even be discouraged by the fact that you are not discouraged a lot. Think about it. Discouragement is highly contagious. Discouragement spreads by even casual contact. Please wash your hands. People can become disheartened because you are discouraged, and it does spread like that. You can be burned out because other people are discouraged. This morning, we're going to look at Nehemiah's struggle with discouragement. We're going to focus on both the causes and the cures for discouragement. Because it affects you, because it affects me, because Nehemiah brings this potently to us. So first of all, there are some external causes of discouragement. There are two main types of discouragement. One set of problems comes at us from the outside. The other set attacks us on the inside. Let's look first at the external causes of discouragement. The wall workers were initially very excited. We saw that in chapter 3 last week. And they began the work with great anticipation and joy. And it says of them in verse 6, that the people worked with all their heart and things were going really well. The people were excited and the wall was going up, and then something happened. Getting the work started on the wall was a major achievement, but keeping the workers working proved to be a much tougher assignment. Someone has said that exhilaration is that feeling you get just after a great idea hits you and right before you realize what's wrong with it. Where God is at work, the enemy is also at work. And so rebuilding the wall of Jerusalem was certainly no exception to this. So when people take kingdom priorities seriously, Satan stirs up agitators to block the work of God. Whenever we feel, and I've seen this week in, week out here, whenever we feel, oh, we're just getting near a breakthrough, remember this, that Satan also has his ears open. I've tried to teach myself over the years in ministry to be encouraged at what I see happening, but to not trumpet it from the top of the tower, lest Sanballat and Tobiah are also listening. Everyone's news is not everyone's news. Be careful what you share, be careful what you trumpet, because not just the ears of the saints are listening. There are also the ears of Tobiah and Sanballat and even of Satan listening. And these enemies used two types of external forces. The first one was ridicule. And we see this in verses 1 and 2. Have a look at your scriptures again. It reads like this. When Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he became angry and was greatly incensed. He ridiculed the Jews. And this is the third time in the book that we come across Sanballat. And he was Nehemiah's stiffest opposition. Every time we read about him, he is standing against the work of God. I need to tell you, and perhaps you don't even need me to tell you this reality, that there are people who will stand against the work of God. There will be people who stand about in the way of the work of God in your life individually. They will object. They will obstruct. There will be people who stand in the way of this church's ministry. There will be people who stand in the way of the kingdom of God to make the kingdom come down. So Sanballat, every time we read about him, he's standing against the work of God. He's rejecting, he's ridiculing everything that Nehemiah is trying to accomplish. Somebody has said that ridicule is the language of the devil. Ouch. Those who can stand bravely when shot at will collapse when they're laughed at. I remember as a teenager, and you know, teenagers who are beginning to spread their wings and begin to look at leaving home, begin to get involved in community life. I remember my mother said to me, perhaps with an element of cynicism in, but with an element of warning too, when you stick your head out, expect to get it chopped off. Thanks, Mum. And yet, there is truth in that. The enemy often insults the servant of God. Goliath ridiculed David when the shepherd boy met the giant with only a sling in his hand. The soldiers mocked Jesus during his trial, and the crowd taunted him whilst he was hanging on the cross. And so here in this story, Sanballat and his cronies had begun to ridicule the workers even before the work started in chapter 2, verse 19. They mocked and ridiculed us. And here in chapter 4, he's making a speech before the army of Samaria, and he's intensifying the power of ridicule. Notice that he called the workers feeble. The word, when we take that apart, means withered and miserable. It's an insult. Next, he ridiculed the job that they were doing by asking four taunting questions. Will they restore the wall? That must have made the Samaritan army break out in laughter, in a kind of sarcastic way. You see that so often in life today. Sarcasm can be a real killer. How could a remnant of feeble Jews hope to build a wall strong enough to protect the city from a mighty army? And then the next question, will they offer sacrifices? Sanballat is saying that it will take more than a prayer and worship to rebuild the city. Then the third question, will you finish it in a day? Suggests that the workers had no idea how difficult the task was. And soon they would give up and they would stop doing what they were doing. And then the final question, can they bring these stones back to life? Indicates that somehow the building materials that they were using were old or damaged or inferior, that they couldn't possibly be revitalized to make a strong wall. Look at what you're doing. And so in verse 3, it was Tobias' turn. He steps forward, because it's not just one person's go. It's like a lineup, isn't it? Sarcasm, cynicism, let's give it what we got, the enemies of God. And so Tobias stands forward to ridicule the workers when he tried out a joke on them. What they are building, even if a fox climbed up on it, he would break down their wall of stones. As if we're using children's wooden blocks or some kind of Lego. Archaeological excavations on these walls revealed that they were 9 foot thick. Think about that now. Just get your measurement into your head. 9 foot. That's massive. They would need more than a small fox to knock them down. And the workers became the punchline of every joke. And everyone got a laugh at their expense. And Tobiah hoped that his sarcasm would make the builders cast an apprehensive glance at their hard work and activate within them an avalanche of discouragement. Oh, let's give up. We're never going to do this. Have you been in that kind of place? Whatever challenge you're faced with, oh, I can't be doing with this. Sarcasm and cynicism is the kind of spirit of the age, isn't it? We're never going to get through this. You know, so often in my life, I have seen big, tall obstacles to overcome, and they have been scary. I love what it says, rather cleverly, in management speak. I don't know if you've heard this, but I love it. It fills my heart with encouragement every time. How do you eat an elephant? A bit at a time. I don't know anyone who eats an elephant in one go. So when you're faced with such a massive project like Nehemiah has here, it's simple. You do a bit at a time. And secondly, the second cause of their external discouragement was repression. Verses 7 and 8. The enemies had moved from being bothered by the Jews. Now they become very angry. You see, they weren't giving up God's people. So the cynicism becomes anger. They plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and to stir up trouble against it. I don't know if you can see this, I'll read it to you anyway. This is the quote of one of the scholars. Warren Wiesbe writes, God's people sometimes have difficulty working together. But the people of the world have no problem uniting in opposition to the work of the Lord. You know, this echoes from last week's teaching. You know, when we're faced with unity like we were last week, the challenge of whether we can work together, Warren Wiesbe writes, God's people sometimes have difficulty working together, but the people of the world have no problem uniting in opposition to the work of the Lord. You know, in our postmodern world, where you know, there is this kind of leveled spirituality where it's difficult to know where there is light and darkness. In our town, you know, we see everything New Age just a part of this religious mishmash. We're no longer seemingly able to point at things and say, that's dark, that's light, that's God, that's Satan. And everything's placed in this same bucket. And it's hard sometimes to know where the darkness is operating. We have to have real discernment in our minds. We have to be careful about what we say. So the references in verse 7 are the four points of the compass, if you like, that Nehemiah was up against. Sanballat and Samaritans are in the north. And to the west, Ashdod is on the west. Tobiah and the Ammonites are on the east. And Geshem and the Arabs are to the south. And the workers were surrounded on all sides and lived in constant fear, therefore, of being ambushed and attacked. And thinking about how we struggle, just like the workers, there can also be internal causes of discouragement. Pressures from without often create pressures from within. And opposition outside the ranks can lead to depression on the inside. It wasn't the voice of the enemy that was the most pervasive. It was the voice of God's own people. Can we do this? Yes, we can. We can do this. And just like today, it's so easy to internalize the words of the enemy and to feel like giving up. So often in Wellington Baptist Church, just like any other church, we can shoot ourselves in the feet. We can discourage one another. Why are we doing that? Why are we trying to reach out? It'll never work. Notice the first part of verse 10. It says, meanwhile, the people in Judah said, you see, discouragement started first within the royal tribe of Judah. It starts from within. They had David's blood in their veins, and you would think that they would have had more faith and courage than the rest of the people. They were looked upon as leaders, and they were looked upon as pace setters. If the tribe of Judah were discouraged, then the other tribes would be more inclined to give up the project as well. That's key. We need to be praying for each other. We need to be praying for God's protection over each other. But can I say to you humbly that you need to be praying also for the church leaders? Just like this situation, if our leadership is encouraged, then the hands are held up and all the tribes are encouraged. If we're discouraged, then it has an effect and goes through the church. There were a number areas of internal discouragement. The first one was fatigue. Verse 10 reads, meanwhile, the people in Judah said, the strength of the laborers is giving out. And simply put, the workers were tired. They were hitting it hard and needed some rest. I'd love to take a straw poll this morning. Did you come to church tired? And here we are. This is the moment, the main church day, when we're here for empowerment. We're here to be lifted up. We're ready to go out into the world. Will we go out? Half of us come here today because we've been burning the candle at both ends in the week. We've been living unhealthy lifestyles that actually leave us exhausted, when what we need is to get our life right in the heart of it. When you're physically drained, It's very easy to become discouraged at the slightest problem, when what we need is simply to go to bed early. It's also interesting to notice that when the workers became fatigued and discouraged, verse 6 says that the wall was built to half its height. When we're exhausted, we'll think, oh, we're a bit like the council workers I mentioned last week. It's 3 o'clock, lads, let's crack off. In the white vans, let's go home. It's a bit like trying to start a new project. You know, we're excited at the start. It's going to be great. We're going to build it up. It's going to be superb. In a matter of weeks, we're going to be firing on all cylinders. And yet, on day two, we're tired and exhausted. When the newness wears off and the work becomes routine and boring, then it's easy to become tired. And when you're tired, you're discouraged. I see that in my own life. When you stay up late, even though the adrenaline starts to kick in because you're on sort of extra battery power, you'll pay for it the next day. We used to say that with the kids, didn't we? Keep the kids up late. Whew, wait till tomorrow morning. If you're feeling tired today, watch out. Tiredness leads to discouragement. And remember what God did when Elijah was tired. He sent an angel to give him some bread and something to drink, and he told him simply, go back to sleep. I love the way God can sometimes be so plain. You're tired, you're exhausted. What's the first thing to do? Take care of yourself. Get some fitness. Get some structure to your life. Do not work 24/7 for the firm. Provide boundaries. Clear and workable boundaries that enable us to function in healthy ways. You cannot burn the candle at both ends on a long-term basis. And sometimes the most spiritual thing to do is to go to bed, but not in my sermon. I know who you are, and I know where you live. Secondly, the second thing that can happen is that you get frustrated. Verse 10 continues by saying, there's so much rubble. Claire and I are doing up our house in Portland. And that's how we feel just now. Every time we go through the door, there is a balance of hearts. You open the door and you go, you see the rubble, and then you see what we've achieved. And it's a 50-50 moment sometimes. It can feel like that. You can become discouraged, and they became discouraged because they were so aggravated with the situation. I'm sure they encountered old broken rocks, dirt and dried out mortar, and other debris was underfoot, and the junk was everywhere. You know, I've worked it out with our house in Portland, and I've only just worked it out after 50 years. You see, when I was young, and my dad, as you know, was very gifted with his hands, and he was a royal engineer and so forth, so his talents came out in that way. And do you know what? My dad used to drive me crazy. At the end of doing a job around the house, he'd get the broom out and he'd sweep up every time. And we were coming back on the job the next day, and I used to think to Dad, I really can't be bothered sweeping up. We're only going to create more dust tomorrow. Why are we sweeping up? And the other day, I was working on our Portland house, and I suddenly realized Dad always used to sweep up. Why? Because suddenly, you can see what you've achieved. And the site is tidy. So you come in the next day and you go, wow, we've made some progress. And that's why Dad always used to tidy up and sweep up after each job. And you see, in Nehemiah's situation, it was so easy for them to lose sight of where they were going. And so too, we can lose sight of our goal when we've too much garbage in our lives. Hebrews 12 challenges us, verse 1 of Hebrews chapter 12, to get rid of anything that causes us to be frustrated in our pursuit of godliness. You know the verse. It's great. It's a bit like somehow children when they go to have a bath. Let us throw off everything that hinders. Have you ever picked up after your children as they go to the bathroom? Like this. Let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with endurance the race marked out for us. I don't know what rubble is in your life. Whether you're watching too much TV, whether you're doing too much social media, whether it's a possession you're holding on to, whether there are personal issues that you need to address, whether you're dealing with a drink problem, or you're involved in some kind of entanglement that's tripping you up, something that you're doing in secret that you think no one else knows about, and as the writer to Hebrews says, throw it off. Throw it off so you don't get tripped up. That's why the writer of Hebrews is so clear. Thirdly, another cause of discouragement is fear. And the enemies of the Lord's work had struck fear in the heart of God's people, and they felt like giving up. Remember what they said in verse 10? We cannot rebuild this wall. Look at it. Did you notice in verse 12, who gets afraid the quickest? Then the Jews, it says, who lived near them came and told us 10 times over, wherever you turn, they will attack us. Those most affected by fear are those who live near pessimistic people. If you want to limit the depressing thoughts that bring fear into your life, then it's best not to hang around negative people. Oh, you never do it. You'll never get there. Yeah, just a load of rubbish. It's a challenge, isn't it? Don't bother. If you're going to soar with eagles, you can't run around with chickens. Fear puts us in a frame of mind where we cannot only become discouraged, we can also be deceived. Sixty percent of our fears are unfounded. 20% are already behind us. 10% are so petty they don't make any difference. 5% are real, but we can't do anything about them. 5% are real, and we can do something about them. That's your life, that's my life. And that leads me to this, the cures for discouragement. The first cure is to request God's help. In the jungles of Africa, a man was being pursued by a roaring, hungry lion. Feeling the beast's hot breath on his neck and knowing his time was short, he broke out into a prayer as he ran like crazy. Oh Lord, make this lion a Christian. Please make him a Christian. Within seconds, the frightened man noticed that the lion had stopped chasing him. When he looked behind him, he found the lion kneeling and moving his lips in obvious prayer. Greatly relieved at the turn of events, he got close enough to the lion to hear him pray, and bless, O Lord, this food which I am about to receive. Nehemiah requested God's help in chapter 1 for Jerusalem. And in chapter 2, he prayed a kind of quick prayer that often we pray, you and I, when he was in the presence of the king. Now in chapter 4, he prays 2 different times. He looked up before launching out. He prayed before proceeding. He takes a look Take a look at his first prayer in verses 4 to 5. He says, "Hear us, O God, for we are despised. Turn their insults back on their own heads. Give them over as plunder in a land of captivity. Do not cover up their guilt or blot out their sins from your sight, for they have thrown insults in the face of the builders." And this was quite a prayer. When I read this through first, I thought this is the core of this text. He wasn't praying for his enemies to become believers, but instead for God to judge them. And this prayer was not nice, but it was understandable and honest. He knew that his enemies were really fighting against God, and so he asked God to deal with them. When I was in my first pastorate, not long out of college, and like a lamb to the slaughter in my first church, I was challenged on all sides. One of the most encouraging things that a pastor by the name of Russ, who actually has spoken at our church weekend some years ago, who stood by me in Peterborough, he came and said to me, "Sam, it's simple." "Oh, thanks very much." He came and said, "It's simple. You pray this prayer in your church, and the church will change." "Okay, what prayer do I pray then, Sam?" "It's simple, Sam, you pray this. Change people, Lord, or take them." "Right. Could you say that again, please, Russ?" "Yes. Change people, Lord, or take them." It's the take them at the end that I'm not sure about. "What do you mean, Lord? What do you mean, Russ, rather?" Well, we didn't quite answer that one, but I began to pray the prayer. "Lord, change people or take them." And God did. I'm not going to tell you what he did, but he did. Secondly, the second cure is to reorganize your priorities. In verse 13, Nehemiah said, "Therefore I stationed some of the people behind the lowest point of the wall at the exposed places, posting them by families with their swords, spears and bows." Look at how he changes things. Nehemiah had organized the people in chapter 3 and they'd finished half their task. Now, however, a new situation comes about and he now changes tact. He reorganizes them. And if the enemies were going to attack, they would most likely do so at the weakest places. Do you know that's true in our lives? Do you know that's true in our lives? When Satan's going to attack you, he will attack you in your weakest place. The Nehemiah principle of defense is vital in spiritual warfare. So he puts guards at the vulnerable spots. And this served two purposes. It discouraged the enemy, yes, and it encouraged the people because it dealt with their fear. So when we're discouraged, one of the things we can do is to reorganize our priorities. Step back from your life. Adopt a change in approach. Instead of becoming so discouraged that you quit, reorganize. Be strategic. Why am I spending so long doing this task? Why am I burning out on this? Adopt a new attitude. Get some help. Talk to a counselor. You know, counselors are not just a negative thing. They can be a trainer. Just wanted to get that in. They can train and help us to unlearn ways, so that we relearn healthy ways. Because often when we're born, we're programmed with unhealthy ways, but guess what we picked up from our parents? So we need to reprogram, and counselors can help us to do that. Plug into a small group. Don't be overcome by discouragement. Do something about it. Thirdly, and we're almost into the final tack here. If you want to defeat discouragement, the third thing you can do is to remember who God is. After looking everything over and sensing the discouragement within his team, Nehemiah rallied the troops in verse 14. Don't be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, who is great and awesome. So Nehemiah knew, even in the face of opposition, that the success of the wall was wholly dependent upon God, who inspired its beginning. Verse 10 was true. The people could not rebuild the wall on their own. They needed to remember God and what he promised. I don't know about you. It's true for me. It's easy for me to forget God when things are tough. Back in the days of the Toronto Blessing, before I was pastor of this church, I used to find that when I was prayed for, when I was prayed for and ministered to, that God would force my thinking back onto him. You, Sam, have taken too much control of your life. You need to let me have control. As I was prayed for, so I began to put over into God complete control of my life. And I want to suggest that that's what we need to do too. When you're down, turn your attention from discouragement to the one who's able to do something about it. He's been faithful, and you are here today, and he will take care of you. And he will take care of you in the future. Remember his promises. Remember his goodness. Remember his power. Our God is great and awesome. And I know you don't believe that. Our God is great and awesome. Are we struggling to believe that, my friends? Let's determine to be God gazers instead of rubble gazers. I want to tell you a story in conclusion. It's a brief one. It's a quick one. It's the story of the rebuilding. Sorry, it's the building. It's the story of the building of the Golden Gate Bridge. It's the longest suspension bridge in the world. And during the first phase of the project, 23 men fell to their deaths in icy water. Things were going from bad to worse because there were few safety devices. This is right up your street, Mr. Warren. And so when it was halfway completed, they decided to take another look and make some changes. Do you know what they did? They reorganized and they built the largest net ever made and attached it under the area where the men were working. And was it worth the cost and the time to look at this? Ask the 10 men who fell into it without being injured. Not only did it save their 10 lives, I'm told that the work was completed in 3/4 the time because the workers were no longer in fear of falling to their deaths. Friends, God's great net of security spans our world. So no matter where we live, no matter what we've done, no matter how discouraged we've been, he's stretched out and his everlasting arms are beneath us. And as a result, we can live and work freely without fear, knowing that we're protected, knowing that we're safe and secure. If this morning you find yourself on plan B or plan C or plan D, don't worry, because it's still God's plan. He will never leave us or forsake us.